first time that I've had a glimpse of your new house. The first thing to note is you've paid the electricity bill because I can see you, which I never could. Never could in your last place. Secondly, I love what you've done with the place. I love the
decor. It is a full-time warp. This place has not been touched, I say, since about 1965. Ben says from about 1975,
because
precise. There is a bit of wallpaper that's maybe more 70s. But it is, it was sort of one of those family homes that they were just in for generations. And it is extraordinary. It is a full time warp. The curtains, I've got beautiful textured styrofoam wallpaper, which is
beautiful.
I'm talking about.
That's
everywhere. And I keep catching my nails, like when I'm moving boxes and things. So then it's all coming out. It's terrible. But yes, it won't be staying like this for much longer. Fingers crossed. But you know, these things take time. But it's, do you know what, it's perfectly lovely, as in it's, you know, it's very warm, the radiators are all new, the boiler's new, like, yep, as in all the functional bits,
lovely,
that you need to,
excellent,
live in this house are all fine. It is just, it's just the fashion, it's not quite fashionable. That's what I would say.
Or it's not quite your fashion. It's not quite your taste. Which, you know, it's understandable.
This is what this is no one's taste anymore.
It's gonna, as the podcast, we'll keep giving people updates, because whenever we do these podcasts, I might start to see things change. But I won't see them changing the next few weeks, because I think from next week I'll probably still see the beautiful backdrop. But after that, we're going to be in Paris together for Roland Garros, which is it feels like it's crept up on us, or me, and suddenly it starts a week on Sunday.
Such is the tennis calendar, that there's so much tennis that you're paying attention to that you don't pay attention to what's around the corner. And, even on like a micro level, you're so engrossed in one match, and then maybe you're doing two back-to-back matches, yep, and then another one starts and you're thinking, wait, who's this? What? Where's my research? Especially if one's sort of really epic. It's so difficult to even think ahead at all. But yeah, I can't believe it. Roland Garros around the corner next weekend. Heading out there. We'll both be there. I don't think we'll see each other very much. From a distance, we might.
We're just waving
we
each
will
other
do, yeah,
across. There's like the TV compound. The TV compound looks at a side or a part of Philippe Chatrier, the centre court. And a lot of the time we'll just be waving you from outside the Five Live commentary box and me from the TV.
Yeah.
So we're just waving
Although
each other.
Although I hear so we're an extra floor up. We've been promoted to the TV level studio or boxes.
Oh, have you? So I just have to wave higher.
Yeah, exactly. So don't look at me at the old box. I won't be there.
I'll just hear my name from somewhere and I'll look up and there you'll be. So yeah, I go out middle of next week, and I'm currently in that process with having little ones of, I prepare a survival guide. It's called a survival guide and it's prefixed by whatever tournament it is that I'm going to. And it's everything from emergency numbers to after school clubs to what uniform they're wearing on what day to when the bins go out to, my other half is like, do I need this? And I'm like, I'm sure you need this. So I'm nearly done with putting together my Roland Garros survival guide 2022.
I have seen this survival guide in reality a few years ago, and it is extraordinary, the level of detail. It is pages and pages and pages. Do you think that the people at home looking after the little ones actually look at it very often?
I know certain people don't. I just print off loads of copies. I put one on the fridge, on the kitchen table. I leave one on our bed. I put it in the bathroom. I just leave it everywhere just in case, because I will get a phone call asking me about something that is in the survival guide. So I know certain people look at it. I know certain others don't, which is why I get a lot of messages normally when I'm on air going, is it, what happens today? It's a Wednesday. So I like to leave knowing that I've put it in place.
Yeah.
Even though if no one looks at it, it's fine. I can look at it. I look at it a little bit. And I'll give you a copy if you want.
Perfect. It'll be good. I'll use it. I'll use it as my template. So I just leave. That's what I do. I
love
say
that.
I say bye and good luck and I leave.
Because you know it's going to be okay.
Of course it
They're
is.
They're going to be okay.
It's going to be fine.
I think, you know what? It is more for my own benefit, which is probably why I take a copy with me. It's weird because I think you're more organised than me. But on this front, I think it clears my conscience. I feel, you know, a bit guilty going away. So I just do it. But what we do know, what I know, what everyone knows, there is a new favourite on the men's side to win Roland Garros. Three guesses as to who the new favourite might be.
Yeah, and I'm not keen on this, to be honest. It is Carlos Alcaraz, the new favourite, after Nadal crashed out of Rome with his foot injury. Well, he said, don't call it an injury. It's just, that's how my foot is. It's how it is nowadays. It's not an injury that's going to get better. That's just how it is.
I'm managing it. It's there.
I limp. It hurts. That's how it goes. So he's been taken off of the top spot and it's been handed to Carlos Alcaraz by the bookies, which I personally think is... look, he absolutely could win it. And wouldn't that be hilarious after... Well, it would be a lot of things, but wouldn't it be hilarious after everybody talking, comparing him to Nadal? And I remember even back at Wimbledon last year, all of the new Nadal. And I remember going, guys, you've got to remember that Nadal won Roland Garros at 19. Like, let's, you know, levels here. And now he's going into Roland Garros at the age of 19. He's just turned 19, literally last week. And he is the, he's the favourite.
Isn't there another stat that it's also the same number of Grand Slams in that Nadal was? Like, I think those kind of styles...
Well, I don't think you can do it any earlier, can you? It's physically impossible. It's just not going to happen.
But even Nadal, in a recent press conference, it was a little bit... I remember when Zverev got fed up of talking about his brother Misha. It was always about his brother. And the next thing he gets fed up with quite a few things, but he got fed up about, why can't you do it at a Grand Slam? Why can't you do it over five sets? Nadal is like, stop comparing us. Like, he is brilliant. Stop comparing us. Like, what I did at this point, what I did at that point, what he's going to do. Because as you say, when he burst onto the scene, we looked at the physique, the game style, the sleeveless top. He's Spanish. He jumps around. And Nadal's saying, look, let him be him and I'll be me. Do you see what he's just... Because in all the press conferences, he's either being asked about him or, can you see the comparisons? Can you see the likeness? And Nadal's just like... Look, I'm having and have had my career. Let him have his career.
It's going to be a good one, isn't it? He shouldn't be the favourite. I'm sorry, but Tsitsipas should be the favourite as far as I'm concerned. He's won Monte Carlo. He reached the final last year. He was two sets up. He did everything but win the match. He has the experience. You know, Alcaraz has never been to a Grand Slam final. I just don't think that... for me personally, honestly, my favourite to win Roland Garros is Stefanos Tsitsipas. Like that's what I think. People might disagree with me, but you know, he had a fantastic year last year when it came to the clay, and he's been working towards this for a very long time now. And I think he's been getting closer and closer and closer. And he was within touching distance last year. I'd see no reason. It's not like he's in worse form than last year. Yeah, he's got Alcaraz to deal with this year, which he didn't last. So it might be very draw dependent, because you don't know where Alcaraz is going to fall when it comes to Tsitsipas' section, because it's very different Alcaraz against Tsitsipas in a final than it is in the quarterfinals, for example. That's a very different feel. I think I'd very much be favouring Tsitsipas if it was a final match between the two of them, again with his experience from last year. But if it was a quarterfinal, then you know, maybe you'd be thinking that, you know, Alcaraz is going to have a bit more of the favourite on that occasion. But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one, isn't it?
I mean, I guess look, the bookies coming into this, he beat Nadal and Djokovic back to back on clay with a bad ankle. I mean, that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
you don't do that. And then
it's
and
never
then,
happened.
Sorry.
It's never happened. But I do just have to. It's very exciting. It's incredible what he's achieving. But just a little bit. Neither one of those were at their peak. We didn't have peak Djokovic. We didn't have peak Nadal. Actually, nowhere close for both of them. So, just worth.
But even from a psychological point of view, there's the physical point of view, and I agree with you. He wasn't facing peak either, and he had a bad ankle, so he probably wasn't peak at the time. But I think also I remember, you know, Dominic Thiem, the weakness from Thiem coming from his team talking about it was the psychological side of things. He had the game, but mentally, could he beat one and follow it up with another? Could he be in that situation? It seems that Alcaraz mentally is in a very good place and has a story. I mean, and I think, but if you're a bookie and you're putting everything together, your favourites. So you've seen that, right? And then a quote from him in Marca: my goal is to win one of the three remaining Grand Slams this season. He's also talking a very good talk. And I don't know, the people who put together odds, are the people who do the odds, do they talk to, I know nothing about betting because I would be so bad at it, but when they're putting, say, tennis odds together, is there a tennis specialist that does the tennis odds, or are we looking at people that just look at sport in general? Do you see what I mean? In terms of, if you're a general sports person looking at odds, you see what he's done, you read those quotes, I 100% see why he's favourite. But if you're talking to someone, we work in the sport, everything like that, you'll probably get a different answer for the favourite. Do you see what I mean?
No, absolutely. It's experts, for sure. So I was friends with somebody who used to be, still is actually, you know, one of those experts. I think actually at his company, they had an expert for women's tennis and an expert for men's tennis. Two separate. So it very much is because you need to take into consideration the form, the surface, the everything going on to come up with the most appropriate numbers. You can't just be guessing. That wouldn't get you very far as a betting company. So yeah, no, absolutely, there'll be people who are you know, geeking up on tennis for sure, and have been watching all the matches and been, you know, a big part of it, really. So look, I can understand, it's not like it's completely far-fetched. Like, I think Dominic Thiem was fourth favorite last time I checked. That is so far-fetched that I don't know, something's gone wrong there. But with Alcaraz, I could totally see how, like, if you said to me, Alcaraz is my favourite to win it, I'd be like, sure, I can totally see that. It's just that Tsitsipas is mine.
Yeah, no, as I said, I was just sort of maybe playing devil's advocate, and I can see, yeah, wondering sort of who puts... I can see why people would come to that conclusion, but then you've got to add in five sets as well. And I'm not saying that physically Alcaraz, I think, was Zverev. It was physically, wasn't he, in terms of five sets. How many five sets would he lose? But so it doesn't... It's just, I guess, how he will figure over that format. And maybe he's going to blow us all away. And maybe he's going to be fabulous over that format. I mean, the question for you, in Alcaraz, from what you've seen, it doesn't look to me like everyone can get better. Everyone can always improve. It doesn't seem that there's a weakness. If you were talking to someone who'd never seen him, where is there a weakness? Where is the weakness in Alcaraz?
Well, there isn't anything right now. There just isn't a weakness. Well, I say that there are areas of his game that still need development, and that
of course,
still need that little bit of improvement. I think the serve can still improve a huge amount as well. Second set, although actually his kick serve against Djokovic in Madrid was outrageous. No, there are still areas to improve, but in terms of like a real vulnerability, it's hard to see when somebody's playing well and rolling like this and feeling so good and confident. Then all of your weaknesses disappear. They're not there anymore. It's only when you get a little bit nervous, a little bit shaky, if you're serving for a Grand Slam or whatever it might be, that they tend to come out. Just like Zverev. You know, with Zverev, we say this is just the perfect example. I use him as an example because he is number three in the world. But, you know, he's unbreakable when he's confident. And he cannot get a second serve in, when he's not confident.
Yeah.
And I mean, in Madrid, he had every reason to be confident. And he reached the final, he lost to Alcaraz, and he was not happy about the schedule, which I can absolutely understand. I mean, I don't know how players play in the middle of the night and then have to play the next day during the day. It's crazy. But in his matches before that, he completely lost his second serve. Just didn't know how to do it. He made a complete meal out of a couple of sets. It was really, really difficult. He only hit 2 second serves in one set, in the first set of his semi-final. They're both double faults. So he was just like, I'm not going to hit a second serve. Anyway, all I'm saying is that it's only when, you know, you're not feeling at your best that those things come up anyway. Because when you're free-flowing and everything feels good, like Emma Raducanu, you just keep rolling, smashing through. It just keeps, everything works.
And Alcaraz's drop shot. I love a drop shot. Who doesn't like a drop shot? I love a drop shot.
I don't like a drop shot.
Do you not like... Well, no. Do you like...
I don't like chasing a drop shot.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's different. But when you're watching a play... And largely off the forehands, it's a thing. Oh, I love a drop shot. As I say, I wouldn't want to chase any of them down. But... And he brings that... And that annoys... he's just... Look, he's wonderful to watch. He's got a big smile on his face. I think it was a good decision not to play Rome. I know he's young, and we're like, he's young, just keep playing tennis. But he's had that ankle problem recently. there will be more pressure going into Roland Garros. And yeah, look, he's got a chance. I've said Nadal, haven't I, to win it? I'm going to stick with Nadal. I'm going to stick with Nadal to win it. Is he the favourite? I don't know, but is he the one I think will do it? Yes. So I've kind of, have I hedged it slightly? Possibly? I don't know. Zverev, scheduling. I would hate to be a scheduler because you're always going to annoy someone. It'd be someone who's annoyed. I imagine there's a certain element of pressure from the big guys, you know, to say, look, I don't want to be playing at this time. Not that that should influence anything, but I'm sure a little bit of that comes in from somewhere. And then you've also got to think of the crowd. So who do the crowd want to see at the peak times? And do you have to think of TV audience as well? I mean, it's a nightmare.
Oh, well, you had to avoid the football as well. You couldn't put Rafa on during the football out.
Because he was there. He was at the Bernabeu.
Exactly. He was also going, so you might not have had Rafa on court.
It would work well, wouldn't it?
But you know, you had to work around the football. They had all sorts going on. I agree. Look, tennis schedule's a nightmare. Yeah. It's so hard.
When's it going to end? Don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that would be a horrendous job, and a job that I would not want.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
On Jabeur, we were talking last week and we were both saying we felt it was coming. We felt the breakthrough was coming. She's made the breakthrough. On Jabeur is a 1,000 winner.
She is. And we felt it was coming. Well, we were at semi-finals, weren't we, when we were talking about it? So it wasn't like we really picked it. But
But we talked about feeling as though and everyone could see it, that she was getting closer and closer and closer.
Yeah, she's had to sort of chip away. But it's incredible, isn't it? Just incredible what she's achieved, breaking so many boundaries. I mean, what that means for the sport, for a culture to have an Arab woman at the very, very top winning these huge, huge events. I mean, she could legit, like, it's a possibility. She could get to number one in the world at some point. You know, she could potentially win a Grand Slam. You don't know. I mean, I don't think she's ever going to be the favourite going in, but hey, loads of non-favourite players win slams. It's just absolutely extraordinary. I bet she is a hero for just millions, absolutely millions. And to be doing something as the first, it's just, you know, I can't imagine that, really. Just can't imagine it. I can't believe she's done this well. I can't believe it. Even back to the day when I was getting absolutely chopped up by her. Well, I say chopped up. It was three sets, but I was chopped up in sets two and three. Those bloody drop shots. You know, but even then, I mean, she was so, so good. But it's taken a long time for her to come back. I think that was 2013, 2014. And she was sort of 120 in the world. And love her. Always love to watch Ons. She's one of my favourites.
I love it's the game style, isn't it? I love her game style. I love the way she mixes it up. I love the smile that she always has on her face. I love the way she talks. You talk about her being a role model. You can chat to her. She's friendly. She's warm. She's welcoming. Whenever you have to do an interview with her, it's an absolute pleasure. Some people are more difficult than others. She's an absolute pleasure. You chat to her about football. You can chat to her about the tennis. And as you say, that the barriers she's broken is absolutely incredible. I mean, you know, that we had president sending her messages saying this is, and her family flew over there for the final, for her to then to be able to cross that finish line. I think it's unbelievable. We talked about this a lot, but the state of the women's game, you know, there was that sort of sharp intake of breath when Ash Barty retired for a number of reasons, because we were thinking she'd be there, maybe not for 10, 15 years, but at least for a few years to come, and how she'd set the bar and what would happen now. We're not going to see her. And are we going to see Serena Williams again? And what's going on with injuries to certain players? But the women's game is in these fabulous hands right now, with Swiatek saying, you know what, I'm number one and I'm going to embrace number one and I'm going to roll with number one. I mean, the way she's playing, how she's changed. I thought it was interesting going into clay. Swiatek said, that she always saw herself as a clay court player, but because she's added a different side to her game, getting the success on the hard courts, that she'd almost, she felt like she had not forgotten, but she was going to have to revert to the old Świątek to play on clay again, because her game, she feels, and it looks so different to say a year ago when she was playing on clay.
Yeah, it's amazing how her game has evolved so much. I think so much of it is the confidence, but she is just incredible to watch. I mean, it's just amazing. But the thing is like, I see what she's saying. I'm not disagreeing with her. But when I watch her play, I just think, well, this works on any surface. This is not any sort of specific thing. She's taking the ball really early. Yeah. She's playing very aggressively. She's got the shape on the forehand. She's got the backhand slice that comes in here and there. You know, her serve is so accurate. You know, it's just all of it. It's like, I mean, you could stick her on a court made out of mud and she'd win. It's just, she could play underwater. It doesn't, I don't know. I know that there are obviously those details that change from surface to surface, but I think it really looks great.
With Świątek then, do you think it could be a little bit more mental, as in this is the style she had grown up with playing with? She said, I am a clay court player. It took her the Roland Garros title. She's added, developed and progressed, but it's a slightly different style than she brought to the clay last time round. Could it be mentally she's got to kind of adjust to the player she is now?
Yeah, I think so. I think she's making those adjustments. She seems to have adjusted quite fine, to be honest. I think everything is okay in the Świątek world, but she's going to be going in as the heavy favourite. It's become the heavy favourite over the last couple of months, which is amazing. Yeah. But, you know, she's going to have to make an adjustment to that. But I think that she's just ready to roll. I think she's loving the way that she plays. When you watch her on the court, there's just so much joy, I think, in her competitiveness. And sure, it's easy when you're winning. It's less joyful when you keep losing heartbreakers like Pablo Carreño Busta at the moment. Three times he's had multiple match points PCB. And lost this year.
That just made me think of someone who went through so much heartbreak, having a little bit more success, a little renaissance, is Cilic.
I mean, yeah, man, Cilic, playing really well.
To see the big smile on his face, because that is a man who's been through some heartbreakers, and I thought the knees, and I thought we'd seen the best of him, and that was Cilic. But I'm sorry to take us completely down a different road, but yeah, just I've been quite happy to see some of the success that Cilic has been having lately.
He played so well. I did his match in Madrid against Zverev. He won the first set, pushed him to three. He'd never won a set off him on clay. And he was so, so good for that match. So I'm not surprised that he's been able to pull the results together in Rome. So yeah, good for Marin.
Yeah, I just like seeing that. But yeah, as you say, when things are going your way, that's like anything in life. If things are going your way and you're feeling good, you're on a roll, there's that confidence, there's that belief that you're invincible and you can keep going. So, but I just love the way, and it's a little bit like I love the way that she adapted to being a first-time Grand Slam champion. I love the way she's taken to being world number one. There hasn't been a reaction. Maybe there will be at some point, but she's like, yeah, this is great. And she's being very, I know she's got a good team around her and she works very hard on the mental side of things. And she's working with Agnieszka Radwańska's former coach, and that's added a different dimension to the game. But yeah, I mean, look, they're pushing behind her, but she's the one to beat. And she's like, I'm enjoying this and I fancy staying here. So 100% the overwhelming favourite for Roland Garros. 100%. We both going. Are we saying that now?
Yeah.
Before draws, we do that now, right? Yeah. So we've got Tsitsipas.
Well, her draw is that she's at the top of the pile.
Tsitsipas, Świątek, but as in who else falls into her? So Tsitsipas and Świątek for you, Nadal and Świątek for me. We done? Wow. Okay, that's amazing.
There you go.
Someone else we talked about recently
there
a lot.
There you go.
Look at us all cocky predictions in. Andreescu, interesting that. She was asked recently, Emma Raducanu nursing a back problem, trying to get herself fully fit. Interesting. And I thought this was actually quite sensible to, she was asked in press to maybe give some advice to Raducanu, because obviously Andreescu had this huge breakthrough in 2019, ended with the US Open, but the body thereafter didn't play ball for a while. And I thought it was quite interesting her. So yeah, to a point, she says, look, it's not to me. She's got the people around her. I have great people around me. But I thought it was quite interesting that they asked Andreescu just to give a few words of wisdom to Raducanu and where she's at now.
Well, don't do what Andreescu's done.
<That's> there we probably go, everyone.
What I think a lot of people would say, Andreescu is used now as an example of how even really successful players can get things wrong, and how important the team around you is, and it's important that you have a player that can listen and absorb things that are coming in from the team. You go back to somebody like Carlos Alcaraz, you know, just everything that is coming at him. It's so much attention to detail, the professionalism of it all, but you know that he's just soaking it all up, and you've got to have both of those things. I don't know what the situation was with Andreescu, whether it was that her team weren't pulling her back from playing and she was just saying, or whether it was that they were and that she was saying, I don't care, I'm going to play anyway. Like, I'm playing, I just want to play.
Yeah.
Because she made a number of mistakes, and physically it's really taken a big toll. And there is an element of you've got to sort of wear your body in to playing at that high level and sort of keep it like that. It's like when you come back from an injury, for example, you might feel completely fresh, fit and fabulous, but you can pick up injuries quite quickly because your body's not worn. It needs to be sort of a bit battered, a bit bruised, to be able to take the pressure. And I think because Andreescu, similar to Emma, you know, had such a big breakthrough, and demanded more of her body than her body was ready for. Which is where I think it's slightly different to Emma, because, you know, Andreescu was in those deep three setters, toughing it out at such a brutally physical level, match after match after match. And her willpower was something that I think we probably hadn't seen since Sharapova or Serena, to be honest, in terms of how much she wanted to win. And that even when her body was saying, I cannot play anymore, she forced her body to win. She forced her, like, she just forced it to happen. And it's amazing to see, because, you know, most people, when your body's telling you to give up, you give up. Like, as in 99% of people do that. So it was amazing to see. And then, of course, she came back at the French Open after that big injury. That was too early. That was just because she got impatient and wanted to play. And she said that she really regretted that. You know, so, yeah. Lots of mistakes, I think, and yeah, whether or not Emma's the same, I think everybody's got a different journey to go on, right? But it's very, very hard to not make mistakes when you're a teenager and doing unbelievable things. You know, I think the only way, and this is a difference between the three of them, the only reason that Alcaraz is probably not going to make many mistakes is because of his team, and because they have really had every detail nailed from a very young age. And it's just got such a professional vibe, as in, like, his team setup is as it would be if he was number one in the world.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Emma and Andreescu would want to change things as they got to the top. You know what I mean? It hasn't been done in the same way. But look, hey, if you're Alcaraz, I mean, that costs an obscene amount of money. Obviously, they knew he was going to be very good, but they didn't know he was going to be this good. I mean, they probably thought he might be, he could be, but they didn't know. It's a huge investment to undertake.
But I remember a coach I spoke to a few years ago at Wimbledon, and they said, you've got to invest in yourself because you're the product. And he looks at some players who, and it is a big thing if players have to go in debt or borrow money or be financed or get sponsors. But he said, you know, he gave a couple of examples and said, if they invested in themselves, if they took possibly the short-term hit, it would pay off. But that's also a big risk, because you can make that investment and it might be out of your hands. It might be an injury that derails things. So I imagine, I've never been in that situation, but it's a big step to take. It's a big investment to make. But then I also understood his point is, you are the product. You've got to, if you had a business, you invest in your business to make it grow. And that's the same thing for you guys as tennis players.
Yeah, but you invest in your business for the chance for it to grow. Yep. It might not. And they are risks, calculated risks that people need to take. And a lot of people are very self-aware and have just decided they don't want to take that risk. Other people have just decided, I'm happy where I am. I don't want that, to be honest. I know what comes with it. I know the hard work I need to put in to get there, and I don't want to do it. Yeah. You know, so it's, yeah, I don't know. And then when it comes to coaches, it's difficult. Money is always a big part of it behind the scenes with negotiations, and it's very, very hard. This is an individual sport
where I will just add, in the rules, it says that explicitly no coaching is allowed on court. So how important is your coach? It's just a question. It's just as opposed to, you know, a football manager, for example, who's, you know, you've got a half time to deal with. You've got so many players to manage. You've got subs to make. You've got all of these things. As in, like, he's working probably harder than anybody or she through the match. Whereas, you know, ultimately for the tennis match, you are supposed to be, even though they all coach and we know it, you are supposed to be cheerleading through the match, right? You just become a cheerleader. You're completely redundant. You can't do anything apart from just be a sounding board for your player. So it is quite different. I think that the relationships, the contracts, everything, it's very complicated in tennis. It's not, you know, even if you compare it to, people always compare it to something like golf, maybe golfers with their caddies. A caddy does an awful lot more work during play than a tennis coach should be.
I love it. But as we know,
or even does,
they are coaching.
So they are coaching, but they're not even saying that much, to be honest. They might say a couple of bits here and there, but ultimately this is a sport where you are trained to do it yourself. Your job as a coach is to empower the player to go and make those decisions themselves. Your job is not to make those decisions in live play. It is up to the player. Whereas in every other sport, not every other sport, but sports that are sort of similar, that's your job is to actually make decisions as the play's going on.
I got a question for Coach Cavaday. It's from Nat J, got in touch, saying, what do you do as a coach with a player who clearly shows great promise, has had success in the past, but is on a bit of a losing streak? And we had a bit of a chuckle about this because she was talking about Felix Auger-Aliassime. And ever since her question came in, I was replying saying, hasn't he just beaten Alejandro Davidovich Fokina? Didn't he beat Sinner in Madrid? So she said, yeah, he's doing quite well now. But I think that the question is a good one, in that how do you as a coach deal with that kind of situation?
Say that again. What kind of situation?
So you've got a player. Sorry. You've got a player who shows great promise, right?
Yes.
They've had success in the past.
Yes.
But they're on a bit of a losing streak. So how do you turn that all around and basically get them back on? He seems to be doing it, but how do you get them back on track?
Well, I mean, coaches all have different ways of doing it. Really, it's all about managing the confidence of a player. And yes, the best way to gain confidence is to win matches. Okay, if winning's not happening, you can't really do much about that.
Well, it's chicken in the egg.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
So I mean, it depends on your ranking. So if you're ranked 70, then you just make some scheduling changes and you drop down a level and you win some matches and challenges. That only works if you go and win matches and challenges. If you go and lose matches and challenges, it only has the opposite effect. And it lowers your confidence even worse. So it's a little bit of a gamble. So you've got to have.
And you might lose your job at this point as a coach.
You might lose your job any day of the week as a coach. But you, as a coach, you need to make that judgment. Are they going to go and win matches and challenges, or is this actually a real confidence or crisis? And we need to be very careful as to which matches they're losing, because they're just going to keep losing for a while. Aside from that, in terms of winning and losing, you then have to just break it down into the game. I mean, how can you build up your players' confidence within their game? Like, what needs to improve? What can they do better? Then you've got to start trying to build that confidence when it comes to practice sessions, practice sets, drilling. As I say, in specific areas, and try and give them, you either try and repair something that the player think is broken, or you try and give them something that they didn't have before, because there's no, you can't just leave them as they are and expect confidence to just turn up. Like, it's just not going to happen. You have to be making some changes, and, you know, try and address those things. I mean, probably do a little bit of both, do a bit of repairing, a bit of developing of something a little new. And then you can talk to your player before a match, and you can genuinely say to them, okay, well, this is sorted out now. It was a worry before, but it's not anymore. And also, hey, you can do this. You couldn't do that before. Like, this is great. You know, like a Swiatek on the clay, right? You know, you can do all these things now. This is it's exciting for a player. They like going on court, showing off their skills. And when something pays off in a match that you've been working on with a coach, you always see these really nice exchanges between the players and the coaches, when, and you can see that the coach knows that that's something you've been working on for ages. You just get a little smile, a little look of like, yeah, that's because sometimes you get these reactions and they're not necessarily about the stage of the match. They're not necessarily about the point. You know, it's sort of a bit jarring. Like, it's like, well, he's very, very pleased with something that looks sort of basic and, you know, or, and it's like, it's 2:15:30. Doesn't, you shouldn't be as like excited about it, but it's normally because they've been working on that for ages and they're like, oh, finally, I've been trying to pull that off all year.
And even if they go off and lose the match and they're playing, coming back from confidence, and we might in commentary say, well, it's now however many matches in a row, etc., 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 for them there might be a small victory within that defeat, in that something they were looking to change or work on or achieve, they've achieved. So we might look at it and say, well, that's now however many defeats, but they've just got to focus. I'm not going to say follow the process and stay in the moment, but they've just got to, I guess, focus on their own journey. So if they are changing things, as you say, that little look, maybe despite the defeat, is like, well, that's a little win, because that's something we've been looking at. Do you ever, as a coach, would you ever just take them by the shoulders, or you might not do that, and say, you are good, this is what you are capable of? Or if someone's not feeling confident, that won't, because there's so many times where we say, you could do this, you've done it before and you're good enough, whatever, in everyday life or whatever. As a coach, would that have the kind of effect, or do you have to go about it a little bit differently than the obvious of, you are this good?
No, I mean, that can make up the bulk of it. Absolutely. It can have a really big impact. I mean, rewatching matches from before when you were playing very well, you know, all of those sorts of things. Of course, you know, players need to be reminded that their headspace that they're in at the moment is just how they feel at the moment. It's not the reality of who they are as a tennis player. But that's, I suppose, the same in life. But it's a big challenge for coaches. But what I would say is that it's a lot less pressure to be working with somebody who's losing than somebody who's winning. So it's it sort of swings around about. Yeah, you have, yeah, probably more to do in terms of your coaching insight and ability, like you and your skill level as a coach. You have to deliver, you have to make changes, whereas when everything's going very well, you don't have to do that much, because you've just got to manage, you've got to fight fires, you've got to make sure this train's allowed to keep going, right? You think of Juan Carlos Ferreira right now, you know, it's how do we keep this going? But I tell you what, the person who's going into Roland Garros with all the pressure as a coach would be Juan Carlos Ferreira. His player's the favourite,
because he's got the best player in the world right now.
Exactly.
Under his wing.
Exactly. So you have sort of different things. And it is quite nice as a coach, because once your player has been losing for a while, like, or they've had a bad run for a bit and they're a bit disappointed, it takes that pressure off, and it also gives you the room to make developments, to make improvements, and that's very, very important. And it's helpful as a coach in terms of delivering things, but also it is just good overall for the development of a player, because, you know, we've seen players that will do very, very well very young. Somebody like Zverev. If Zverev hadn't have won as much as he did, yeah, he wouldn't have had as much pressure to keep winning, and he might have been able to sort out his second serve. He might have had the room to do,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
The coach might have, his dad, who was coaching him at the time, might have had the room to go, do you know what, right, we're gonna sort this out, because you keep losing matches because of it, so let's sort it out. Whereas, you know, he was number 3 in the world, I think, by 20 or however old he was. You know, he was very, very young, winning Masters events and stuff. So you just don't, and the off season is not long enough. You have to be doing it through competition. So it means that you're going to have to take a hit to your results to be able to develop. And, you know, who's going to do that when you're 20 years old, number 3 in the world? You're just going to go, I think what I'm doing right now is absolutely fine. You know, you are, right? Like, that's
yeah,
that's just it. And also it becomes very difficult for a player, even if, say, Zverev got into a headspace where he was losing all the time, it's very difficult for him to listen to a coach who wants to make big changes, because he's like, but I got to number 3 in the world with this serve. You know, Ostapenko and her serve, there was lots of chat about it after her French Open victory and how she needed to make technical changes. She was like, I just won the French Open with it. What do you mean make changes? What's wrong with you? Like,
you're fired.
What are you talking
you're
about?
Out.
This is ridiculous. So, but again, it's about that confidence. And it's like, well, yes, when you're feeling that good and playing ridiculous high risk tennis all the time and it's working, then sure, it's great. But like, that's not going to happen for the rest of your career. So I don't know. There are pros and cons to all different situations, I think, that coaches find themselves in. Personally, the hardest or the most stressful job is to work with the very, very top.
Nat, thank you for your question. I think if anyone else got a question for Coach Cavaday, they can get in touch with us. I'm excited about Roland Garros. We've made our predictions, so we haven't got to do that next week, whether we record in the UK or when we're in Paris. I've now, I get real mum guilt ahead of going away, and I'm now just under a week till I leave. And the children, the twins benefit massively because I feel so guilty I'm leaving. Keep buying them stuff. I'm like, here, have this. They're like, oh, this is excellent stuff. And they're like, oh, I'm really going to miss you. It's going to be very sad. So the next day I'm like, oh, have this. It's just my sort of, whether it's kind of sweets or little treats or let's go out here. It's pure mum, love my boys, but it's also pure mum guilt. And they kind of like, oh, I see. So you're leaving. And then you'll bring us big presents from where you travel to. So yeah, I've got to go out and get the latest mum guilt offering ahead of pickup. So I'm going to go and do that. But I'm looking forward to us being together, waving at each other, having not spoken to each other across Roland Garros. And I don't know when we're going to record next week. Might be when we're in Paris, might be before. But yeah, I can't wait. We're actually going to be together at a tournament.
I know. Let's go.